Wow, that is. That's Busted Pencils Saturday. Man, coming at you, Dr. Tim Slecker, Dr. Johnny Lupinacci, Jacob, Chairman of the Boards. One full hour. Glad. I am so glad to be back. I feel like it's been, I don't know, a couple days since I haven't seen you both together. But it's been longer. Well, John, the three of us together, right? I mean, because I had to hang, you know, do something, John. You had an excused absence. Foundation of Busted Pencils, Jacob, Chairman of the Board, has never left us, Johnny.
Yeah, he's the anchor. He's the rock. There's no doubt about that. And we'll bring you up to speed, but we've got a little WWE flair to the show right now. We bring the big energy. Jacob and I have been flexing the oh yeahs and the, Kool-Aid Man influence of, you know, busting through the wall and bringing all that energy because, you know, like most weeks, this one has been a doozy. You know, so we're interested, though, before we jump in, because, you know, we got into the weeds a little bit, but we also flew high above the trees this week, and we can get into following up on class and session. But Tim,
you're a condor. Know,
yeah, that, something like that. Yeah, okay. Be the bird. That was one of the lessons this week. If listener, you didn't get a chance to catch it, well, you'll get a breakdown in today's broadcast. But go back and grab class and session, and you know, Jacob and I, we dug in and we talked about higher ed. But Tim, before we jump into that stuff,
all right.
I mean, what's some stuff that's been popping for you this week? Like what have you been noticing about public education here?
Well, nothing exciting. You know, the Trump administration, 100 days of, you know, nice, calm, easy breezes. Not okay. Johnny, that's sarcasm. Just to point that out for you. It's been crazy. And hey, let's hit this one first. Last week, the feud between President Donald Trump and Harvard, that's what my mother-in-law would call it, or Harvard, if you're from, you know, Western
most of the world.
Western Pennsylvania, like me, Harvard. It escalated again. And, through the constitutional powers that he doesn't have, through the executive order, pen and paper. Hey, Harvard, international students, and Jacob, I love how you said this before the show. All of them, even the white European international students, you're out. Harvard, you cannot recruit them in the future. This one is mind-boggling. I want to see this story develop more, you know, over the day, so that next week we can really hit this one. For people that are hearing this, particularly higher education everywhere, particularly everybody in Wisconsin, does that have ramifications to the higher education institutions in your area? Not yet, but I know that's the fear of saying, wait a minute, we're outlawing international students from one institution. What institution is next? And Jacob, as you said, is that even legal? Jacob.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it myself. I thought I don't know the procedure. Maybe there's some obscure, you know, 18th century law that says that the president can ban international students. I'm not a lawyer, but it just seems so transparent to me that at a time when Trump hates Harvard specifically and that Harvard has been kind of standing up to him. I mean, obviously this is trying to get at Harvard and cost them money, because you talk about the demographic crisis for higher ed all the time. Am I correct in saying that it's a lot of the foreign students that end up paying the full prices to come to American universities and make up some of that shortfall?
That is definitely one of the issues. I mean, there are scholarships and there are students here, but Johnny, right? I mean,
unfold, because this is the Department of Homeland Security, and it's claimed to be, you know, a punishment. I'll call it that.
Go ahead.
From what I've read about it this week is, you know, they were requested. Well, they were accused of, you know, being a facilitator of hostile environment, on campus for allowing protests and having, you know, anti-Israel sentiments allowed on campus. And we've covered some of the back and forth between the federal government and Harvard over the years. And, you know, Harvard is one of the top institutions in the world. I'm going to emphasize that again, the world.
Mm-hmm.
And our institutions like that are comprised of people learning and also teaching from around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there's been a little bit of back and forth. And according to things this week, you know, Harvard was asked to turn over the conduct records of all international students and refused to do so.
Mm.
So like Jacob said, they're going to get into the legal weeds on this, I'm sure. But they said in response to Harvard's refusal to turn over those records, which I have to imagine rather flippantly, I'll say, you know, are related to HIPAA and stuff like that. I mean,
right.
Can't just fork over, you know, information like that. But in the essence of it, you know, said, well, now you are not permitted. And that's where we're going to see how this unfolds. And they actually, you know, dictate, and I'll emphasize that word again, dictate, you know, who can and can't be at that premier, you know, global institution.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the other message being like, this is how tyranny works.
And there you go, man.
You know, I mean, like the message being like, the message, you always talk about a chilling effect, Tim.
Oh,
the message being like, just stay out of the way of the big bad boss, right? Or, you know, he's not just going to walk softly and carry a big stick, right? But he's going to, you know, be loud and boisterous and bring the big stick with them through that process. And so, you know, it's a tyrannical kind of leadership in the Department of Homeland Security, certainly flexing on, how did you say it? You gave your best Boston impersonation. Harvard. I can't even do. I'm bad at accents, period. But, you know, on Harvard. So we'll see how that unfolds. But like you said, I think it's pretty transparent. And Jacob mentioned it too. It's like, oh, coincidence.
Yeah.
You know, you're beefing with Harvard and you're just like escalating the beef.
Yeah.
Right. So we'll see what kind of unfolds with that. But, you
can
know,
I want to make a prediction, though. Let me make a prediction on this one and we'll hold this. That way we come back to it. I think President Trump, this is a bridge too far. This one is going to come back and bite. And I really think this is where people are going to start to go, wait a minute. So, Johnny, there's me being optimistic for a change.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm going to sound like an apologist. So I give, you know, my apology for sounding like a apologist or a sympathizer of, you know, the current administration. I'm not, but I'm going to say it's also a particular kind of tactic, right, of leadership. It's a different kind of leadership than probably you or I would have, Tim, or that we know to be successful, you know, studying leadership, especially being learners, leading learners.
Mm.
But it's a kind of leadership that says like, oh yeah, we'll try this on for size. So it's sort of like when, you know, when you're disciplining your kids, and you say, hey, you're grounded for the weekend. You know, maybe they didn't do a homework assignment they were supposed to do, or they didn't do their chores. Every parent out there has been there. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, well, you're grounded this weekend. And they say, oh, yeah, I'm still not doing my chores. And you say, oh, yeah, well, you're grounded for 6 years.
There you go.
Like it's one of those things that is like it reminds me, it's akin to that kind of irrational leadership. It says like, oh, yeah, try this on. Well, we're gonna hit you hard. Somewhere that hurts, that likely we probably can't follow through on. So I have seen a pattern of that from this administration.
Going with that one, you're right. You're grounded forever.
Yeah.
This also kind of reminds me of one of my favorite movies too, The Triple Dog Dare. And at this point right now, The Triple Dog Dare, I think, has now been employed at this point by Trump. If we look at this, Jacob, you know where I'm going on this one?
Not at all.
Okay, well, then we'll come back to it. But, you know, Triple Dog Dare, who's going to get their tongue stuck on the frozen flagpole? tune in to Busted Pencils because we're going to watch that flagpole and tell you whose tongue gets stuck there. Johnny, one other thing, too, before we get to, you know, your flying condor and above and below and in the weeds. One other news story. We've been covering this for the longest time. Oklahoma, everybody knows, was trying to be the first state in the union that would authorize public dollars being used to fund a Catholic charter school that went through the courts. The Oklahoma Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. It's blatantly unconstitutional to use public monies to fund a religious affiliated charter school. The appeal went to the Supreme Court. I know Jacob and I had a long discussion about this at one point. And there was a 4-4 decision today. Why four? Why not, you know, the split? Because there are 9 Supreme Court justices. Amy Coney Barrett recused herself because of potential affiliations. I put respect out for her for doing this, for her affiliation in Catholic education. She stepped down, recused herself. 4 justices then said, yes, Oklahoma, you were right to stop that from happening. 4 said no. In this type of ruling, this is interesting, and I want to explore this more too. We don't know who voted for what in this one. This is allowed to remain kind of hidden. The question is, which conservative, let's be honest, which conservative justice said and moved over and went, yeah, I feel like this is unconstitutional too. I'm going to put it out there. My bet is John Roberts.
I mean, this is the democratic process as it exists working. You know, Tim, we've talked about it. Separation of church and state. Mm-hmm. Public funds shouldn't support religious identity schools. You know, the ruling came down and no Catholic charters receiving public funds in Oklahoma. I want to say we could put that one to rest, but we'll keep talking about it because it'll take us into the weeds.
Yeah.
Speaking of weeds, Tim, when we come back, let's get into them.
Absolutely. I got my weed eater. Blended education talk. Dr. Tim Slecker, Jacob, chairman of the boards, and Dr. Johnny the Condor Lupinacci joining us, you know, here. 10,000 feet. That's what I understand. Johnny did a little research on the height of birds actually flying, you know. So give us your field book report, man.
Well, Tim, I was just, you know, mentioning the class and session this week. I shared a little, what we might even call it, a fable, story, a little nugget of wisdom from a mentor for arrows who, you know, shared a story about, you know, some like be the bird. Sometimes the bird lands and, you know, in the trees or down in the weeds to whether feed or rest or do whatever it does on ground level or slightly above ground level. I would say 300 feet or less is, you know, landed on something. And then I said, sometimes you got to fly up way above the trees. Mm-hmm. And I arbitrarily grabbed the number 10,000 feet. And I even mentioned to Jacob on the fly, like, I'm grabbing this number out of the sky, you know, and hopefully birds can fly that high. Well, yeah, most birds can fly that height, although they tend to stay, you know, at 300 to 500 feet kind of maximum. There's no need for them to go much higher, but they can fly that high. And some species actually spend quite a bit of time up there. So, whew, we're all right.
Ooh, you're good.
There's a lot of birds. It doesn't have to just be some rare species. So birders out there can co-sign on that little, you know, ad lib, grab a number and apply it. And it worked.
I just got to say, though, when you said that, though, I mean, you said, you know, bird, and I quickly went, you know, bird is the word.
Bird is the word. But, you know, the idea being, the metaphor being, like, we talk a lot about education, public education, and we talk specifically on the show here there about higher education as part of, important part of public education, and started today's broadcast off, you know, with a little update on the beef between the federal government and Harvard, higher ed topic. But, you know, we've been talking about higher education and some of the big picture stuff happening in a change of landscape. And that story, you know, that lesson embedded in the story that, you know, Four Arrows shared with me, you know, it seemed applicable. And the idea being, the metaphor being, like sometimes you got to be in the weeds or in the trees and you see what's going on around you. You got to be close to those details, the specifics. And we get into the specifics often enough, but it's also important, especially as a learner leading learners, those of us educated educators and you pencil busters out there joining us to talk about education, you know, it's important for us to sometimes leave the trees, leave the bushes, leave the ground, and take the 10,000 foot view, right? And fly way up above the tree line and see, you know, the forest through the trees and as and see the landscape of things. So I just build on that little story and that metaphor and to pass it on, to pay it forward to all our pencil busters out there, you listener. But, you know, really, I was trying to find a way, Tim, to kind of categorize some of the big areas of change
in higher education.
And I think it's applicable too to K-12. Yeah. Although, you know, it's a little different at the K-12 level. I would say it's more traditionally democratic. It's less business-like than higher ed is facing right now. But you know, I categorize those things and you know, I'll lay them back out there for you. And listener, if you want kind of that or where these things come from, it came from class and session this week. But Tim, I threw them into four categories. The first being, I think it's really important when I fly high above the trees of higher ed and I look at the big picture of the moment we're in. The first area kind of I observe is that there's need for attention around academic program innovation. And I see you already getting excited because I happen to know.
Nice.
And this is your area of passion.
Nice. Right?
Academic program innovation. We can get into that. The other four categories. So one, academic program innovation. Two, college access and financial aid. Right. So accessing programs and paying for them. Three, related to that, financial realities. Right. Whether we like it or not, we're in kind of a recession. We're in tight financial times, especially around funding higher education and how we fund higher education and what costs our students are, you know, in that context. So the financial realities. Four, being supporting student evolution. Talked about it here before, but change in student demographics and also simultaneously change in what we know supports them as different kinds of learners. Gets into like quality of instruction and all that kind of stuff. So change, you know, supporting student evolution. And then fifth one, which I'm kind of interested in too, it's connected to all of these, is I see a big, you know, area of this so-called forest of higher educational landscape, a need to brand focus, to think about our strengths in higher ed, our unique, you know, brands. And I hate to sound like such a market liberal here, I'm really not, but faced with all these different domains and challenges and the change of landscape of higher education, I think it's an important call, you know, to look at our programs, to look at our quality of support, to look at costs of education. But as we wrap all that into it, be able to really clearly identify what are our unique strengths across the different options that are out there for people looking for continued education or higher education or going to college. All right. So like, what's our brand? Really focusing on our strengths and clearly identifying those. So those are kind of the big four areas I saw when I left the trees. And I said, you know what though, Jacob, we got to get Tim on this because all these happen to be really close to Tim's expertise. I feel like you flying up high and taking that 10,000 foot view, and that's a conversation.
Wow. It is definitely a conversation. You hit on, Johnny, you said four, but you actually went over five, man.
Added the fifth there, five.
Brand strength. Yeah, put it there. Yeah. You know, and two, a reminder, why are we talking about this? Big news last week that Jacob and I covered was the closing, or the proposed closing, and they will close, of seven, Jacob calls them satellites, branch campuses of the Penn State system. Why? Enrollment. Just very simple. Enrollment. There is not the enrollment to support those institutions anymore as individual institutions, even as they were originally set up as essentially a 2+2 type of program where you went there for 2 years and then you went to University Park for 2 years. And guess what? There are just not enough students to support that program. And here's the biggest, you know, one of the reasons: the University Park campus, it needs more students. So more and more of those students who would have been sent to those 2-year schools are being accepted to the University Park campus. And so you have that. All of that explains that situation. I know, Johnny, you gave a great primer on the similarities between the Washington State system and understanding that. But now let's move out there. Like you said, let's get out there and say higher education. What's going on? Because I've shared with it, I've been part of the collapsing of institutions of higher education. And there are, Johnny, you hit five issues here that I think these are opportunities for higher education to actually come out of this and go, wow, these are places that thrive. You know what? That's what we do here on Busted Pencils. Saturday, thriving. See you in a minute. That music just makes me imagine beating on drums really hard. Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk, educated educators talking education. Jacob, chairman of the board, Dr. Johnny Lupinacci, and me, Dr. Tim Slecker. It's Saturday. Love being with particularly everybody in that civic media family, whether you're listening on the app, whether you're listening on one of so many radio stations across Wisconsin. Hey, you're busting pencils with us, and we really appreciate it. Johnny, you laid into this, gave us five areas. I'm just going to say five areas where higher education, if we're going to take seriously this issue of enrollment, and again, there's a lot more to it there. Let's kind of talk about these other realities. And Johnny, you said, number one, academic program innovation, near and dear to my heart. Yes, I will tell you. In fact, you know what I did today, fellas? I took a trip to the Northwoods Flight School.
Nice.
And you know, well, I knew I'd want to get about 10,000 feet up to understand. So I go to the, no. So right now, one of the main responsibilities in the position I currently have is innovation and at the higher education level. And what I was doing, and I thought this is a great way to introduce this, is here's an example. There is a flight school within the service area of the institution I'm at, and the owner of the flight school is very interested in actually saying, like, hey, we've got pilots here that, you know, have to get a pilot's license. Now they're required to get an associate's degree. But here's the reality of the pilot is that, you know, this is kind of like, you know, one eyesight injury and you're done being a pilot, you know, mandatory. And so he's thinking, going like, we want to set these pilots up for, you know, what's after flying, you know? So whether it's wanting to be a school teacher, whether it's wanting to be a home security analyst or homeland security analyst, you name it, right? But he's very interested in saying, I think that these pilots need more than. And would you, your institution that you're at now, Tim, be interested? And so I went up there and listened to them. You know, it was really cool. Got to see the planes that they're flying in and training. Thank goodness, or maybe not. Really, really horrible weather today in Pennsylvania. And had they asked me if I would have gone up, wanted to go up and see what it's like, I would have said, absolutely not this time. You know, not in this kind of weather. I will look forward to it. But here it is, though. And this is one of the top priorities of my university president and provost. In fact, when I got on the ground just this week, when they went over, Tim, here's what we want you doing right away. This was in the top two priorities, to create this partnership, to innovate something that serves the region, serves a need of these students, and allows then for our institution to expand what it is we do beyond that traditional sitting in a classroom, accumulating credits, and then graduating here. And so this is an innovation that we're attempting. Johnny, I see, you know, this is one example, truly flying at 10,000 feet, probably even higher.
Yeah.
Of 30, this, right? This kind of example of saying, this is the type of innovation that institutions of higher education really have, and I'm going to phrase it positively, an opportunity to step into these situations, these partnerships, these realities of who our students are and what they need, and really become their partner in helping them learn and get to those goals that allow them to stay and remain a continuous learner. So this is an academic innovation. Add to that, Johnny, you said micro-credentials, condensed programs, all of those things. But this is one idea that says, wait a minute, I can go to flight school, I can get an associate's degree, and if I'm in this program, I could go to this institution of higher education and become a homeland security analyst with a bachelor's degree. I'm in.
Yeah.
There. Good idea. What do you think?
Yeah, that's exactly a great example for listeners, because when I talk about academic program innovation, I mean not exactly what you described in all the creative ways. And it's linked to that fifth aspect, Tim, I talked about all of the institutions needing to be brand focused strengths. Like, what are the needs of our community? If our mission is providing learning for people in our community, well, a big piece of that academic program innovation that I brought up was aligning to careers. And I love the example you shared, Tim, because it's not just the skill of becoming a pilot. It's looking at the longevity of a person's investment.
Right.
As they're preparing to become a pilot, are there things they can do that make them, and again, limited by my vocabulary here, because I cringe a little bit about this, but are they marketable in a variety of capacities? Mm-hmm. Or are they strictly, like your example of becoming a pilot, limited to, well, if my eyesight is perfect and remains perfect for, you know, the next 35 years,
right,
which, you know, is probably unlikely. So all of our programs being mapped out to like career aligned returns on that investment, that mm-hmm. time and that tuition that a person commits to, what do they get out of that? And being really creative, you know, thinking interdisciplinary across institutions and partnerships. These are great. Like, that's what I mean about, like, when we fly 10,000 feet above the forest of, oh no, enrollment is down. Well, yeah, it's down. But what are some of the root causes to that? And rather than just like mire in that, we say, what's possible for us to do differently? Let's be creative. Let's be innovative. And let's be learners leading learners. Great example, Tim, of that academic program innovation.
Yeah, Johnny, before we get on to number two, like you said, number five really hits this one, brand strength. Because, you know, guess what? If we achieve this partnership, and actually I'm glad you pointed this out, this will be a partnership between community college, flight school, and a regional public higher ed institution. So three ways. What a brand story to say, this is what we do here. You know, that that really is, there's a story there. And for me, whenever somebody talks about brand, brand comes back and to me and says, what are the stories people tell about you? What are the stories people tell about your institution? Good brand, people have great stories to tell. They're unique. And so here that that one. Johnny, then, you know, access, financial aid, and, you know, holy crap. I start with that access one because to me, that has always been the driver, whether it's an incredibly selective institution like Harvard or not, you know, access. What are institutions doing in the realm of access? Who are even imagining themselves as being a potential student learning at an institution? For the longest time, higher education has pretty much said, here's what you are if you're going to go to college. Here's what you need to do. And if you don't do these things, sorry, you don't get access. I don't think that that's an opportunity. And to me, how does an institution of higher education pivot towards more access is that actually we start to see what we offer and we start seeing learners, Johnny, as you said, as going, how is it that we actually can help more learners achieve their goals as opposed to how many more students can we enroll?
Absolutely, Tim. And you know, we've talked about it a lot in the realm of education in terms of alternate pathways to becoming a teacher, right? And grow your own programs and different innovative, creative partnerships in communities and states around this country. And how I've been really phrasing that, we kind of just popped out of class and session this week, is I was saying, like, we in higher ed talk about traditional and non-traditional students. And I think it's time to turn the page and move into a new chapter that they're just our learners.
They're learners.
And that it's no longer all of our major program. It's a bad habit of mind of schooling to think about, well, okay, what are these 18-year-olds graduating from high school going to do next year? And what are they going to do for the next 4 years? And that model of education, certainly they're included in that group of learners, but we think about who traditionally constitutes being a college student. And then we talk about non-traditional college students, and they may be second career folks, or, you know, maybe after serving in our armed forces, returning to school, you know, we have this category of non-traditional students. And I think we've turned that, or we're long overdue for turning that page and ditching those labels and thinking more broadly about who are learners.
Who are learners?
How are our programs accessible to that larger community of learners, whether it's hybrid, whether, you know, it's transfer partnerships between programs. Just coming back to your example about the flight school, right? About you have a partnership between, you know, a community partner, a community college, and a state institution. And so you're looking at, like, there's a pathway of transfer and interdisciplinary and dual enrollment that historically we'd say, oh, those are non-traditional students. It's like,
right,
those are just our learners.
There are, the, and like you said, yeah, I know we're, man, we're, time is flying here. We're going to get, we wanted to get through all of these, but I'm so glad you pointed out, you know, traditional, non-traditional, sorry, that you got to do away with that, because even now within that realm of what we used to say traditional 18 to 22 year olds, that group of students themselves within that population, they're so different. You have students, you know, the idea of going to college and sitting back and learning, you know, I had more traditional, quote, undergraduates working 30 to 40 hours a week, going to school full time. That isn't, quote, traditional. And so we just have to realize that our students, as you said, Johnny, they're learners, and learners have unique needs, unique situations. And as institutions committed to helping their learning and us being learners, we're going to then make every opportunity to accommodate and give access, going back to that one, access to those students. Financial realities, just want to cover it. Financial realities, student support. We did cover brand strength. Johnny, financial realities, man, and budget cuts. I was wondering, like, what were you, you know, hit me with what you wanted me to say there, or
Well, Tim, I just want to, like, as I'm thinking about this, the, like these areas, these large domains are sort of observations I'm making from a 10,000 foot view of the necessary change in higher ed. Look and say like, hey, this forest is on fire, and I fly up above the trees and I want to say like, where's it coming from? What are some of the, what are some of the observable patterns? And one thing is I always like to know why. And so we could say like, oh, it's enrollment, but let's even fly higher and say, what's causing some of the enrollment issues, and why is the gut solution, like the knee-jerk reaction for institutions, which are, you know, if we're looking at this from a business sense or a business mind, and we're like, hey, we need more students because our budgets are really contingent on student, like buns and chairs. Okay. Right? And so, and I, you know, buns and seats. Like I'm really leaning on the actual physicality of that. We're limited by that understanding of sort of in higher ed world, what do we call them? FTEs, right? Yeah. That's one of the things like these budget lines that are antiquated because one, our student demographic and their accessibility has changed. So they could be accessing programs through online or hybrid. They could be, you know, a number of different things. And so the knee-jerk solution is, well, we need more buns and seats. Mm-hmm. And that's just not really happening. And understanding why and understanding our brand and our product more, I can't leave out the part. And that's why I put in a budget financial realities. I can't leave out the fact that we are experiencing a big crunch financially as a nation and as a world. Like stuff has gotten too expensive sometimes to rationalize or to actually participate in. So we're seeing a big sort of classes organizing around like who can even afford to be in these programs. And so these are financial realities that I want as part of the conversation.
Man, we're gonna come back with your big dollars. Busted Pencils. Oh. Wait, the last segment already? It is. You know, hey, but you know you love Busted Pencils every Saturday and, you know, downloading on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you download your podcast. We appreciate it. Dr. Johnny Lupinacci, Chairman of the Board, Jacob and me, Dr. Tim Slecker, we are here breaking it down. Johnny laying out, you know, five areas where higher education, you know, looking at the 10,000 foot view, what are some of the issues? That's not even a tie to enrollment. These are just things that, you know what? I would say if you are in the business of higher education, if you're not addressing these five items, I'm not sure that, you know, you're really doing everything that could be happening. I know I'm stepping out on a limb there, John, but I mean, these are really important. Not, you know, people saying, well, you're just doing this because everything's falling apart. Maybe, but these are just realities that could make, and I'm going to say it, the product of higher education truly valuable because this really helps. And there's lots of others. But John, you talked about, you know, let's hit this one before we close the show, the financial realities. You haven't heard the budget cuts. You know, I saw this very simply as going, hey, look, particularly state public institutions that rely on state allocations towards their budgets, you know, that helps them set tuition prices. As those budgets have been cut, institutions of higher education have to raise the price to make budget. And college students are now sitting there looking at it and going, you know what? I can't do it. I can't do that price. And that's a reality. So that's a financial reality, John.
Yeah, absolutely. As well as one that I think invites us to a conversation around saying like, we can't just put the burden on more students. Let's get more students. That's one dimension of it, but it really like also invites us to financial realities is, and I'd like to get right to the core thing, Tim, is we would say like, as people who have been part of public education at multiple levels, that it's like, hey, legislators, you've historically support. Public education is a bedrock of democracy. So tax dollar allocations have to. So I think we continue to make those cases and arguments. But at the same time, you know, we also look at, as institutions, part of our brand strength focus being also like, yes, we teach. So tuition dollars are one income revenue stream. But what else do we do? What services do we provide? What products are we, you know, part of? Like, how do we diversify our budget incomes so that we're not, our survival isn't necessarily hinging on, let's get more buns and seats. Get them now. Right. Like, people can't have babies fast enough to keep up with that. So it's just a bad long-term sustainable model. So it's really embracing those realities. Is like, hey, even if what brought us to higher education was, you know, doing research and teaching, let's also be part of a generative conversation to say, what else can we offer and do together as, you know, unique, innovative partnerships, bud, develop and help change the landscape. Or like the metaphor I've been using, stop the forest fire here.
Well, I'm going to give one example too, just so you know, the listener goes like, wait, wait, I don't know what you're talking about. How does a college diversify its revenue streams? Well, okay, don't think too hard about this one, but here's, you know, when we think of college, people think, oh, I got to pay, yes, you pay tuition to get a degree. Well, let's just not go too far from that and say, actually, colleges are institutions of higher education, higher learning. What if we decided to offer different types of learning other than degree programs, right? You know, so we can offer a credential in, you know, maybe generative AI use and how to make the world safe for the future of AI. Just, you know, playing up on my strengths. But there, I mean, that's not far, right? It's like, but that's a diverse revenue stream.
Absolutely, Tim. And we've seen this. This is not new. We've seen like agricultural programs say, hey, we also specialize in these products and we have, you know, like a brand or something also that brings revenue into our college or our program. Similarly, thinking like how often, Tim, have we, you know, been critics of testing companies writing curriculum?
Right.
Well, why aren't our best and brightest in College of Education's, you know, saying, hey, we've got a really great way of teaching math, or we've got a really great, you know, and focus on like, here's a product, right? Mm. That's already part of the system. So there are a lot of ways we can begin to learn from. And again, hold at bay, because I'm pretty critical of everything being marketized.
I know. Right?
So, but at the same time, it's like, it's part of the financial reality. Like what are we doing to not just continue to pass the cost on to students? Because that model, I think it's antiquated. It's old. It is why one of the contributing reasons to why enrollment is down, right? Yes. It's just like, it's not a good cost investment for people to be enrolled in some of these institutions.
It comes down to this too. Let's just be honest here, as we're, you know, almost there. It's almost time. But this is really that opportunity for higher education to change the cultural narrative of being not for the company, you know, higher ed ruining everything. This is higher education's opportunity to step in and culturally help the public understand why we value and why public higher education particularly is absolutely essential to economic strength, democratic strength, and just plain old happiness. And
now, trust.
And now for your moment of zen. I do remember I once read, "The cry of the poor is not always just, but if you don't listen to it, you will never know what justice is."
Thanks for listening to Busted Pencils broadcast today. Remember to grab great podcasts chocked full with more fully leaded education talk on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and of course, at the Civic Media website, where you can always find us at bustedpencils.com. Hey, and don't you be late for a special Memorial Day homeroom on Monday, and make sure you catch next week's class and session on Wednesday. That's right. And you can always catch us just like today, Busted Pencils broadcast, 3 p.m. Central Time across all the Civic Media Network stations for 1 hour of your favorite blue collar scholars, Jim and Johnny, and keep busting pencils.